Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Powerful Patient. This is Joyce Graff, and sorry for the little bit of a late start. We had a technical problem right there at the beginning, but we're here today with our guest for Dr. Melanie Rotenberg. Hello, Dr. Rotenberg.
Hi, how are you? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you so much.
Okay, good.
Yes, perfect. So thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting
me,
Joyce.
Before we begin the conversation, I wanted to tell you all a little bit about our sponsor. This program is brought to you each week by the VHL, Family Alliance. And let me play you a little bit of information about VHL, and then we'll be right back to speak with Dr. Rotenberg.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
Thanks and welcome back. Hello, Dr. Rotenberg. I understand that you have a book called Laugh Yourself Thin, so I'm very curious about the title of your book.
Okay. What would you like to know? It started a couple of years ago with an idea at a writer's conference, and really came together when I was talking to one of the editors of a major publishing company, and I was telling him that I love to write and that I'm a physician and actually teach now. I'm on the staff at the University of Central Florida. And I also do stand-up comedy on the side for corporate and for healthcare entities. And I said I'd like to put together a weight loss book because the number one cause of disability in this country, and I'm a disability doctor, is being overweight. And so we came up with, basically he helped me in a little session come up together with this idea of laugh yourself thin, which is what came out of that discussion.
Great. So tell us a little bit about, you work in nursing homes and so forth as a disability doctor, you were saying. So tell us what that involves exactly.
Well, I've been in practice here in Florida where I live for about 16 years. I trained up in Temple University up in Philadelphia in the field of physical medicine and rehabilitation. And that's the field of working with the disabled or in chronic pain patients and such. And there's a wide spectrum of people who practice in the field, but mostly my interest is in working on the severely disabled or people who have complex medical issues resulting in disability. And so I focus my practice on working with people who are either hospitalized, and I consult on people who are in the hospital and have become disabled or are already disabled and are hospitalized. And also most of my practice, though, is devoted to nursing home patients who are, for the most part, getting rehabilitation and hoping to go home, but some patients who live their lives out in nursing homes as well.
So they may be recovering from some surgery, that they have a short-term disability, or they may be there because of a permanent condition.
Exactly. And what's interesting, and one of the reasons that I was driven to write the book, is my patient population. If you think about nursing homes, you think about the traditional nursing home patient population was very elderly, and you know the average age used to be about 85, but that population age is dropping rapidly because our society is getting fatter and fatter, and so people are becoming disabled and severely disabled at younger and younger ages. And what really drives me now is I'm seeing patients in their middle years and even younger who are becoming severely disabled from obesity and are living either temporarily or permanently in nursing homes.
Hmm. That's interesting because the population is generally getting older, so one would expect that the nursing home population would be older rather than younger.
Right, right. But, you know, there are, we never used to see younger people at all in nursing homes. And so we're seeing, there's certainly that variety. But in where I live in Florida, we have probably the big, I do believe we have the biggest population of nursing home beds, you know, and nursing home patients in the country. And most rehabilitation goes on, you know, in nursing homes now because of the guidelines, changes in insurances and Medicare guidelines. And so that's where most rehab goes on these days. And that's always been my focus with working with the disabled at any age, but the severely disabled.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So when you do, tell us about the stand-up comedy routine that you began to do. You said you worked for medical conferences and things like that.
Right. It came out of some charity work. I started it as a, I actually started the stand-up comedy about 7 years now. It started as a dare around my 40th birthday. I was on a cruise with my husband, and we met a comedian there, a professional comedian on the cruise who's still doing cruise ships to this day, and I keep in touch with him. And he is a molecular biologist, so that's what he wanted to be, and he ended up being a comedian, the guy said. And my husband is a molecular biologist. My book is co-written with my husband. My husband's the funny guy. He's the one that blurts out most of the funny stuff, although I'm learning from him to get funnier and you know, learn to craft humor. But he was, my husband's kind of the quiet guy, sits in the corner, kind of the geeky one who, you know, at the party isn't real talkative or extroverted, but comes out with the really funny lines that just have everybody cracking up. And so we were on this cruise ship, and I turned to my husband and I said, hey, you're funny too, and you're a molecular biologist. You could be a stand-up comedian. And, you know, we saw his shows a couple of times during the cruise, and by the end of the 10 days on the ship, I kept elbowing my husband, saying, why don't you become a comedian? And my husband finally turned to me and said, I don't want to be a comedian. Why don't you become a comedian? And I said, fine then, I will. And it sort of started as a dare, and I began to write down all the funny things that my husband or I said, or my son, he was now 16, said around the house, or things that I overheard at work that were funny. I'd ask patients for permission to use their funny lines, or things that happened at work with the nurses or the therapists, and that sort of became the beginning of my monologue. It took me about a year to put together a 10-minute monologue, and they're healthcare-oriented or science-oriented humor. It's not the kind of nightclub humor you might see, you know, for the college crowd or something like that. But I started doing it for charity work originally, and that I still do that. I mean, I enjoy doing that, and I still do it in nursing homes. I've done hospitals and but I really have started to take it to a wider stage now. But what I really loved was combining the humor with the factual information, and that's where Laugh Yourself Thin came from. It's a true weight loss book that is full of factual information, university-based information. There's actually scholarly citations in the back because the book was published with a major textbook publisher, and they insisted it all be very thoroughly researched and university citations. And they call it a scholarly work, but there's lots of stand-up comedy, you know, laugh-out-loud kind of one-liners and things like that that are just sprinkled on every page throughout the book, and funny stories that are almost all true stories that, you know, just make it a read, because most people don't read weight loss books. They might buy one and say, I'm going to use this, and they'll read a chapter or two, and then it'll end up on the shelf. But I wanted people to really, you know, learn the information, and the best way to read, I find, is to make it fun. Especially something like this, which is full of there's a lot of negative emotions with weight loss, and especially if you're thinking about traditional dieting. But, I mean, for most people, when they're thinking about losing weight, it brings up a whole host of, you know, negative emotions, frustration and fear and anxiety and anger. And so I wanted to turn it around and say, let's make this fun, because the truth of the matter is I gained 50 pounds with my pregnancy when I was pregnant with my son. And it took me a few years to lose it. And it wasn't until I figured out that unless I enjoy eating and enjoy activity and exercise every single day and really have fun with it, it wasn't going to be permanent weight loss. And that's what I wanted for myself, and that's what I want for my patients. And I really do believe that.
So how do you make weight loss fun? Because as you say, it's a chore. It's a job. It's not.
It's not a chore and it's not a job. And see that, you know, if you have that in your mindset, then that's what it becomes. So the whole my book's divided into thirds, and the whole first third of the book is devoted to the mind and the behavior, because if you can't think about it in a positive manner, it's not going to become a positive experience. But there is a way to make it fun, and there is a way to turn it around, because what we found is the happier you are, the more likely you are to lose weight permanently. And if you look at weight loss as a lifestyle change, that this is something you're going to do for the rest of your life. So there's no start date, there's no stop date, there's no date I'm going to lose 20 pounds by Christmas or whatever, because you're not talking about changing a behavior temporarily. You're talking about thinking a whole new way for the rest of your life. And then when you do that, it becomes fun, because what I talk about in the book is finding ways to eat that are fun. And I give, you know, ridiculous examples, but to emphasize the point, you should enjoy your food. You should not restrict it. So I gave the example of, you know, what's wrong with putting black olives on all your fingers and trying to eat, or what's wrong with having a food fight over dinner, but I'm not coming over your house if you do that and cleaning up. But I mean, there is ways to there are ways to have fun. I say, you know, have a food fight, but don't fight your food. And I give really, you know, hard evidence. There's good evidence to back that up. If you're restricting what you eat, then you get into deprivation mindset, and then you will not lose weight permanently. You may lose it temporarily, but then you will overeat or you will binge eat later. And you will not learn the permanent methods to eat a balanced life and to eat foods that are good for you rather than not so good for you. The other part of that, if I can go on for just a minute, is the activity.
Sure.
And most people who are overweight, let's face it, are just not active enough. Well, 100 years ago, the average person on this planet exercised an average of what would be the equivalent of jogging 7 to 10 miles a day. And that's because most of us were farmers 150 years ago, and most of us had manual labor work. And now we've become very sedentary as a culture. And so, unfortunately, we're still eating as much, or if not more, because if you look at the calories that the average American eats now compared to even 50 years ago, we're eating 300 to 400 calories a day more than we did 30 or 40, 50 years ago, and we're exercising much less. So how do you make that fun? And the answer is you find things that are fun. You don't look at exercise as a chore. You look at it as something that you integrate into your life all day, every day. Like, I'm dying, Joyce, to get off of this radio call when I'm done, because the first thing I'm going to do is hop on my bike and go for a ride before it gets dark out, because I really do enjoy riding around on my bike in the afternoon. Now I live in Florida where it's still warm enough to do that in the winter. And get out and outdoors.
Warm enough here.
No, it is. I'm sorry. Most of the places it's not right now. But, you know, find something that it doesn't have to be that hour a day either. The other thing is people get in this mindset that I have to slave away on a treadmill for an hour a day. I'm like, throw away the treadmill. You know, get if you're not enjoying it, don't do that. Find what you enjoy. Most people who lose weight permanently, large amounts of weight, and I mean more than 30 pounds, are going to do it by a walking program. But I can't walk. I got bad feet, and so I stopped doing that about a year or two ago. I went to biking. I'm in the pool. I'm doing other things that are fun, that don't hurt, that make me uplifted. And I will tell you the truth is that exercise is a mood enhancer. Activity is a mood enhancer. So you really will make you feel better when you get into a habit of regularly doing something. It doesn't have to be a no pain, no gain. You shouldn't be hurting. You don't have to exhaust yourself. Just 10 minutes here and 5 minutes there to start out with and go from there. But I think, unfortunately, the medical establishment has pushed exercise as almost like a medical prescription, and we need to start thinking about it more as going back to activity, just regular activity we're doing all day, every day that is fun to do, because it makes us feel better mentally and physically.
Mm-hmm. Right. So let's say we're talking with someone who is basically healthy at this point, then those kinds of pointers work. What if there is someone who already has some sort of disability, mild or medium? Where do you start with that? If walking is out or bicycling is out, what other alternatives are there?
Well, that's for the average person out there in the world today who isn't disabled. But, yeah, you're right, because pretty much every single one of my patients is in a wheelchair, and I get every single one of my patients to exercise because they don't come to me walking. None of my patients are walkers pretty much when I meet them. But all of them can exercise in some way. And I work in my main facility to work at, the skilled nursing facility where I do the rehab with my patients, is a wonderful, upbeat place where the therapists and the nurses are, you know, very positive and happy and joking. And we've got the patients in there laughing no matter what they're doing in the therapy gym. And you know, whether it's throwing balls, I mean, I had a patient, I just have to say, last week I was in the facility in the physical therapy gym, and we had a 90-year-old woman. I mean, she must have weighed about 77 pounds, and she was standing up, and she was just trying to remember how to stand again because it had been a while since she'd been standing. Very frail woman. And she was standing there and bouncing a ball against the wall back and forth. And the therapist was working with her on just, you know, balance exercises and standing. And it was, you know, it was a good exercise. And she was smiling. I mean, when I said to her, it's probably been, what, 70, 80 years since you did this exercise? And she laughed about that. But think about that. When's the last time you were bouncing a ball or having fun like that? And you can make it a great experience. We use the Wii, which is a great, the video game. It's a big feature in therapy gyms. It was not developed originally as a therapy tool, but it's become a very exciting. And my patients who won't do anything else, they'll golf and they'll bowl on the Wii, and they're getting exercise that way. And so sometimes we start at a very low functional level to get patients moving, but every single patient gets moving, and then we progress as quickly as we can, but within whatever their tolerances are. And you can do, you can do exercise sitting, standing. I had surgery last year on my foot and wasn't able to walk for months. Believe me, I kept myself very, very active at a seated level.
Uh-huh. So whatever moves, you should move it. Is that a good
arms,
place
legs,
to start?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. And, at a wheelchair level. Right. I mean, if you can push a wheelchair or you can push a scooter, I had a wonderful little bicycle type scooter, and it was making me work pretty good. It was a manual. I used my other foot and even would pull myself down the hallway with the handrails in the nursing home. And believe me, I was getting a good workout every day while I was seated. So you don't have to be an ambulator to be an active exerciser. And if you've ever seen wheelchair basketball, or wheelchair games, you'll know
right.
that people can sit and be in the best shape possible. I used to have an outpatient office where I worked with spinal cord injury patients, and I had one young woman I remember who was an avid kayaker on our rivers down here, and she was a quadriplegic, but she kept herself very, very trim and thin and very active, and it didn't hold her back.
So when you say she was a quadriplegic, so there was some problem with the use of her arms, but obviously if she were kayaking, she was doing something with her arms, right?
Yeah, she wasn't a complete quad, obviously, and she was probably a C6-7 level. But she couldn't get in and out of her car herself. She would meet her friends by the river, and they would pick her up out of her car and stick her in the kayak and make sure that she was holding properly, and she had some adaptive straps to make sure she didn't drop her paddle, and she would kayak with them every weekend. She had no strength in her legs. She was in a wheelchair, but she had some strength in her arms enough, and it was the kayaking was actually her therapy. It was physical therapy for her because it strengthened her arms, strengthened her torso, helped her balance, helped her endurance, her heart and her lungs, but most importantly,
right.
helped her brain and her mood. Think about that. I mean, think about being
yes.
out there in the wilderness every weekend with your friends. Think about the social implications. You've got all that social support that should be part of a good exercise program. If you don't like to exercise alone, find yourself exercise buddies. Find yourself activity buddies to have, because that can sometimes be the best motivator to keep you in a program like that.
Mm-hmm. So even if you start with the bowling on the Wii or something like that, then that's a place to start, and you just sort of compete with yourself and continue to move up?
Absolutely. I got to tell you that I do consult. I do receive consultation requests to see patients in the intensive care unit. And my husband, we have a joke in my book that sometimes I feel, you know, like I want to shout out, drop and give me zero. But these patients are that impaired. I mean, they can barely move, you know, and they may even be on a ventilator, or they may be unable to, you know, barely lift their arms. But I'll follow them through rehab. We get them into therapy. We get them moving. They're exercising. They're getting up, and some of them are getting up out of their beds in the intensive care units. So there are very few contraindications for activity. I will tell you one thing that bothers me about our modern medical establishment and our culture is that there are so many warnings against exercise that have been built into our medical culture, so that people are told, ask your doctor before you start an exercise program. And I firmly believe that impedes people from taking care of their health. I truly believe, now I'm not telling you to go out and run a marathon if you've never done it, or
right.
You know, kayak across the river. Obviously, you start very slowly at your endurance level or what your level is and build up. But I truly believe that our society are couch potatoes, and it's much more dangerous to be a couch potato than to have activity and exercise. And it's much more dangerous to sit and do nothing because of fear of what might happen. There are many more people in this country who drop dead from being sedentary than drop dead from exercise. And unfortunately,
okay.
we've restrained ourselves.
And walking is good for nearly everybody, right?
Oh, absolutely. If you're having pain when you're walking, though, you know, I mean, because sometimes people who
right.
are disabled are not walking in a comfortable manner, then if you can get fitted for orthotics, or you use an assisted device, or you need knee braces or whatever, it'll make you comfortable, great. I walk or run now. I started out walking after my foot surgery last year, but I've been running in the pool for more than 20 years on and off. I did that up north when I was in Philadelphia. I trained, like I said, at Temple, and I started reading about pool exercises and water jogging, and I got into that when I was still in residency, and I bought myself a flotation vest, and so that kind of walking or running in a pool is really good for people who are both overweight and disabled, because the pool, the pool water warms joints that may be painful otherwise, and it lifts the body for people who may have a weakened arm or leg, or, you know, have a bad back or something like that. So there's a lot of Y programs and exercise clubs that will have a heated pool indoors, and I strongly recommend people who otherwise feel it's uncomfortable to walk or to run to consider doing that in a pool environment.
Right. Well, you raised a good point, though, that we're always cautioned to check with your doctor before you begin an exercise program. And, of course, nobody should go from 0 to 500. You know, if you haven't been moving much at all, you shouldn't sign up for a one-hour, vigorous physical therapy. That's really not a good idea. But certainly to start gently, as you say, with a Wii or with a modest walking program, start with a block or two and work your way up.
Actually, I was going to bring up the point that you were saying, Joyce, especially because we're coming up on New Year's now in our discussion,
right.
And people come up with their New Year's resolutions and say, I'm going to lose the weight I've been saying I'm going to lose. And that's the number one New Year's resolution is weight loss. But what happens is most people, when they start an exercise program, especially in a diet mode mentality, is I've got to lose a certain amount of weight by a certain date, is they throw themselves into a fitness program full force, and then they're hurting. And then what happens is two things. Number one, they either hurt themselves and have to stop,
mm-hmm.
or it becomes uncomfortable for them and they want to stop. And that's where I am saying start slow and build up, because you're much
yeah.
more likely to stick to the program. It's those people who do that sudden onset of a whole lot of exercise and go to the gym for the first time in a long time and are doing a whole hour of weights or whatever, or just at home. If you're doing, you know, bands and you decide to do 45 minutes and you're working with therapy, bands, you know, those stretch bands, and you haven't been doing it in a while, and 2 days later you're just aching everywhere, you're not going to stick to the program. So start slowly. You know, give yourself, be gentle with yourself. But the truth of the matter is, if you do it that way, you're much more likely to stick to it in the long run and give your health a much better lift permanently.
Right. So if you start gently and work up, maybe start with 3 days a week and see how it goes, then you probably don't need to see your doctor. But what are the signs that you do need to check in with your doctor or modify what you're doing in order to really stick with a weight loss exercise program?
Well, I mean, there are still the typical contraindications, and I do go over those in my book, but you can find those pretty much anywhere. The most important one is obviously cardiac contraindications or reasons why you shouldn't exercise. If you have any concerns, you have a heart disease, a history of heart disease, a history in your family of heart disease at a young age or sudden death at a young age of anyone in your family, meaning 40s or 50s even, if you have a history of high cholesterol and hypertension that isn't well controlled, if you are a smoker, if you are somebody who maybe has palpitations, certainly you would want to check with your doctor too. And those are all written out. So there are obviously reasons you might. But if you're, you know, if you're otherwise healthy, there's no strong family history or personal history of heart disease, then you can do that. But, you know, the other big contraindication is an orthopedic or neurologic reason, perhaps an unstable neurologic condition or an unstable orthopedic condition like a fracture in your spine or something like that. So if you have any concerns, talk to your doctor, or if you have a physical therapist, you might want to run it by a physical therapist or an occupational therapist, because even things like osteoporosis, you may want to modify your exercise program. Somebody who's got brittle bones, for instance, may not be wanting to lift weights right away. I mean, weight bearing on your spine is good in the long run, but in the short run, it may actually aggravate something in terms of worsen a fracture, a bone break in your back. So there are some contraindications, but for the most part, if you're not in one of those categories, you don't. For instance, also another thing would be like if you have a hip replacement. Obviously, you've already been taught what are the things you shouldn't do with your hip replacement short and long term. You don't want to pop your hip out and have to have more surgery. And I've seen my patients do that on occasion from not following their hip precautions. So things like that. A lot of it is very common sense. But then obviously, if you're exercising and you suddenly start having chest pain, or you're nauseous, or you're sweating too much, or you feel absolutely overwhelmed and exhausted, you're doing too much, you need to call 911 or get, you know, to a doctor right away to make sure you aren't having a heart problem. And those would probably be the big reasons not to just proceed with an exercise program.
Yes, but for the average American couch potato, we're probably fine just getting up and walking around the block and then building up from there.
Oh, that's the best thing to do. It's absolutely the best thing to do. Start with what feels comfortable for you. You would do it anyway. Let's say, you know, it's after turkey dinner. Make sure you digest a little bit, right? Or it's after, you know, you're just deciding you're going to get up in the morning and meet your friend up the street and go for a little bit of a walk. Having a, you know, walking and talking discussion with someone will help you to know if you're exercising at the right level. If you can talk and be comfortably talking while you're exercising and you're not feeling short of breath and you don't have to stop in the middle of a sentence to grab your breath, that's a pretty good indication that you're exercising at the right pace. You don't want to go any stronger than that, particularly when you're starting out. And that's probably one of the best ways to gauge if you're exercising at the right pace. You really want to get some endurance training in there when you first start out, but it's better to go a little too slow than a little too fast, absolutely.
Very good. So now what about the sort of food wars? You know, in the kitchen, you decide to lose weight, but everybody else in your family is not losing weight, and they're begrudging you keeping them away from their desserts or whatever, mashed potatoes and gravy.
Yeah, you know what? I
know that. How do you handle things like that?
Yeah, it's really, you don't deprive. Well, don't get into wars with your family because you're never going to win those. You know that. But you don't want to deprive yourself. I eat mashed potatoes and gravy. I eat everything, and I love everything. I'm one of those people who just loves you know, food. There's probably just about nothing you could put in front of me that I wouldn't eat, as long as it's, you know, as long as it's not crawling at the time. But the basically, or it's staring back at me. As long as it's not staring back at me, I don't need anything that's looking back. But the truth of the matter is, you have to understand that when you start depriving yourself of sweets, I have to tell you, I had, this is a true story, I ate a very nice tort for breakfast that a friend of mine brought over as a Christmas gift. And that's a ridiculous breakfast. I don't do that very often. I usually have my oatmeal, but today I had this tort as my breakfast. And yes, indulgent, absolutely. But if you don't indulge yourself once in a while, then you're absolutely going to feel deprived. And you're more likely to gain the weight back if you're constantly feeling deprived. You could lose it temporarily, but in the long term, I'm looking at long-term permanent weight loss. If I don't let myself eat things, then I'm always going to feel like I'm being mean to myself. You don't want to feel like that. You want to feel like you're doing good things for yourself and being upbeat, positive. Eat more of the good foods rather than the not so good foods. So on most days, I'm eating oatmeal and whole fruits and vegetables. And I talk about it in my book extensively. What the research shows is that you should never really feel very hungry. You should never feel deprived. If you eat frequently, smaller meals that are full of good quality foods, you will be more satisfied, less hungry, and lose weight. And that's what's amazing, because there's lots and lots of data to prove that that truly does happen.
Right. So is the secret portion control or what? If you're still eating all of the different kinds of things and the the fat contents of the foods that you were eating before, then what is it that makes the difference? Is it all exercise or what?
No,
else?
No. You could exercise like crazy, but if you're still eating too many calories, more than you're exercising, it's a very simple equation. You know, you have to cut the number of calories you put in, and you have to exercise, you know, more calories to put out to lose weight. But what happens is that you can eat. People get a little confused with portion control, and that's why, you should control the portions of the not-so-good food. So, in other words, that tort, I had the whole thing in front of me. Obviously, I didn't eat the whole thing. I ate one slice of it, and I put it the rest in the freezer, and it's going to last us a couple months in the house because it's only for special occasions, and it's just about my favorite food. But it's going to stay in the freezer, and what you have to learn is not to eat multiple portions of that, because you're going to realize it's there. It's not going anywhere. Nobody's taking it away from you. So they find when people are told it's okay that sweet's not going away, people are less likely to overindulge in that. So sweets in my house stick around till they go bad, believe it or not. And I love sweets, but because I know it's always going to be there for me when I need it, I don't feel I have to overindulge. And the research actually backs me up on that behavior for the average person who is overweight. The thing is that you have to include in your diet more of whole fruits and vegetables. So instead of apple juice, eat a whole apple before a meal. You will feel much more full. If you will eat less calories the rest of your meal. If you eat a salad at the beginning of the meal without a lot of dressing on it, or a very low calorie dressing, or just dip your fork in the dressing and then eat the salad, you will feel much more full for the rest of your meal and eat less. The other thing is to just put less on your plate to begin with, because we as Americans have learned to clean our plate. So the average American puts about a fifth to a third too many calories on their plate to begin with. If you just cut back about a fifth to a third of your plate and you finish it off, eat a little bit more slowly, then you will actually feel more full and more satisfied and more happy, and it works.
You mentioned earlier using your freezer as a way of keeping you from feeling like you need to finish it all before it goes bad. I've learned to take that cake or something, cut slices, and put each one in a little sandwich bag. And then you can just take out a slice. You don't have to defrost the whole thing. I also keep bread in the freezer, so I can make a loaf of bread last 2-3 weeks. That way.
Absolutely.
and have nice breads that I enjoy. But if you feel like you have to go through the loaf before it all gets you know, green and fluffy, then then you're more likely to eat more of it.
You know, it's funny you should bring that up. In the book, in Laugh Yourself Thin, I talk about that, about some of the techniques, because I have like hundreds of them like that that you can use that really do work and are proven to work. Because I did a lot of research into reading the food behavior literature. And so it's funny because, you know, humans have a lot of food behaviors. We are suggested by food. You know, think about food up to, you know, multiple hundreds of times a day, believe it or not. And our behavior is different person to person, but a lot of our food behaviors are learned. One of the most interesting that Brian Wansink, who's a professor at Cornell, I believe, who wrote the book Mindless Eating. And Mindless Eating is a really fun, enjoyable read, and it's a funny book, but it's full of great research. But he showed in study after study that he did in his food laboratory that people will eat about 30% to 40% more of even something like stale popcorn if you give them a bigger bag of that stale popcorn than a smaller bag when they're sitting in the movie theater. Same way at your kitchen table. If you're eating out of a large plate of food, you will eat a lot more of that plate of food, like a plate of ribs or a bowl of tomato soup. He did a fascinating study where he had people eating out of bowls of tomato soup. They couldn't lift the bowl off of the table, and they weren't allowed to touch it. They were just allowed to, you know, use their soup spoon. And they had rigged up the soup bowls to be refilled under the table with rubber hoses. And so the people kept thinking they were emptying their bowls, and the bowls kept mysteriously filling up, and they weren't paying much attention to that because they didn't know that was what was going on. And what was hysterical
right. Is
the people who had the refillable bowls ate a lot more before they got what they said were full. The people who actually didn't have the refillable bowls ate a lot less of it and got to full much faster and had a lot less calories ingested. And they've done study after study to show that people tend to use their trigger of when they think they're full by when the bowl or the plate is empty. And you have to start thinking in those terms. People who are overweight only start eating for hunger about 40% of the time. So about 60%, more than half of the time, you may be starting to eat for reasons that have nothing to do with hunger, and you probably stop eating not related to when you're really full, but for other triggers in your environment. And so that's
I've read some studies that seem to indicate that a lot of people who are overweight just don't have that kind of off switch. They don't have that feeling of fullness.
Right, and you have to relearn it. You can relearn it. One of the best studies that I based my suggestions in the book, Laugh Yourself Thin, came out of the National Weight Control Research Studies. And I think it's a great series of studies that are two universities put together. But it's based on thousands of volunteers who are people who have a history of losing at least 30 pounds and have kept it off for at least 5 years. The average person in that research study, though, has lost 66 pounds and kept it off, I believe, more than 6 years. And you're talking about really successful permanent weight losers, and they look at their behavior. And these people really do follow a lot of the behaviors I'm talking about with, you know, cutting back their calories and exercising every day, eating small meals frequently, and all the things that we're talking about today, and really positive behaviors, a lot of the happy behaviors you and I have just been talking about.
So what's the reasoning behind eating more smaller meals? Is it to keep your blood sugar more level, or keep your stomach from being so overfilled, or what?
I think you're right with both of those. I think that one of the things is that when you tend to get very, very hungry, you tend to eat, when you finally do sit down to eat or grab something to eat on the go, you're likely to overeat the calories. You'll eat more quickly, and what we found is that it takes about 20 minutes from when you're hungry to when you start eating to when your body starts to register fullness. The stomach starts to register fullness before the signals get to the brain and tell the body to stop feeding food into the mouth. You follow that? So if you're eating very quickly, you can over-ingest calories. calories much more quickly and have a large quantity of overfed calories too much in and before you stop. And so if you eat many small meals a day, you're not as likely to trigger that overeating response. So that's part of it. And I do believe that keeping your blood sugar level absolutely is very important to long-term behavioral management of permanent weight loss.
I'm sorry.
I was just going to say one more thing, Joyce, about that. There was a study that was done. I did mention it in my book, in the book, Laugh Yourself In. I did mention that there's a study they did where they looked at the same number of calories ingested in two research groups. And this was a fun study because one of the groups got, the same amount of food, the same type of food exactly. And they fed these people for a number of days in the laboratory, all their meals. And one group had 3 meals a day and the other group had 17 meals a day. And then they, were measuring them, how hungry they felt, how full they felt, how satisfied they were. And the people who ate the 17 small meals a day were actually much more full and much more satisfied, even though they were eating the same exact number of calories, the same exact food. So I think that's a fascinating Now, I'm not telling you to eat 17 meals a day because then you would get nothing else done. But, I mean, that I think is a very relevant study to yours and mine.
Right, but a lot of the traditional weight loss programs say never, never eat between meals. And they usually tell you to eat 3 meals a day, maybe 4. But you're saying the opposite, that you're actually
I strongly disagree. Yeah, you do what you want. I mean, you do what makes your body right. But the most important thing is to listen to your body. It'll talk to you. And one of the keys
so
is to actually listen.
If you're a snacky type person, then you need to plan your snacks into your total intake and not eat the snacks on top of the food, but hold back part of the food to be your snack.
You know what's funny? I'll tell you, Joyce, I don't even think of snacks. I got to tell you, I'm a physician. I lead a very busy lifestyle, and I have food in my car in a cooler all the time, and I bring it to work with me. I throw it in the little fridge in the doctor's room at work, and I will see some patients, and I'll go eat, and I'll see some more patients, and I'll go and eat. I eat every 2 hours or so or 3 hours during the day, and I eat from the first I get up until right before I go to bed. Sometimes I don't eat right before I go to bed because you can get some reflux if you eat right before then, and I talk about that in the book. But the truth of the matter is that is a much healthier way to live, and the research bears me out on that. But some people, occasionally people, can lose weight and eat only 1 or 2 meals a day or 3 meals a day, but you have to do what your body tells you is right. The majority of people do better if they eat multiple small meals, and I don't call them snacks. Now, I do eat usually a dinner with my husband when I get home or something like that, but I will tell you that I usually don't have any big meals per se. I'll probably eat like half the dinner that would be a normal dinner portion, and I'll save the rest for a couple hours later. I may not eat it. If I'm not hungry, I don't eat it. Save it for that's my lunch the next day. But if you start listening to your body, eat when you're hungry and stop when you're full or even before you're totally full. Eat when you're 80%, stop when you're 80% full. And then, let yourself never get too hungry and never get too full, and you will end up being much more satisfied, happy, not feeling deprived, and you'll do much better, and you will lose weight.
So give us an example of laughing ourselves thin.
Okay. Well, that's a good one. I was just talking to a TV producer recently, and I said, well, this would be a great idea. I was saying, I had just found this online recently. Do you remember jumping balls? They used to have you would have a handle and a ball, and the kids would, jump on. Do you remember those? You know what I'm talking about? They have these bouncing balls.
No.
You sit on the bouncing ball, and you had a little handle.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Well, they have it for adults.
Sitting on a bouncing ball.
Yeah, sitting on a bouncing ball. Well, ball exercise is real big now, but they have a kind now with a handle, a smiley face on it or whatever you want on it now, and you can order them online. And they have them for adults, too. And so I've been suggesting to people, get one for yourself. I mean, you can bounce around your house, bounce outside. It's a great exercise. That's a seated exercise, by the way. It's great for your size. You want to have you want to have magnificent thighs. That's a great way to get magnificent thighs, by the way. But, I mean, think about that. There's no way you could do that with a frown on your face. And so that's just a wonderful exercise that will laugh yourself thin. That's maybe a little bit way out there, but why not? I mean, skipping rope for people who have the endurance to do that. I give the example in Laugh Yourself In. I give the example of pillow fighting. My son, when he was younger, used to love to jump on the couch. And, you know, most parents are, you know, don't jump on the couch. You're not supposed to do that. Well, my husband and I, we made a decision when my son was about 3 years old to buy a jumping couch because, you know, when it's really hot in the summer, he didn't want to go outside. So we bought a full pit. One of those big pit couches. He got a cheapo couch with 10 pillows built into it, and it was the perfect couch for him to bring his friends over, and they would jump on it and play and wrestle, and we had the best pillow fights. And can you think of a better endurance exercise than pillow fighting? Because I tell you, upper extremity exercise like that is an amazing cardiac endurance exercise, and my kid was getting the best exercise, and he didn't even know he was getting exercise. He was having so much fun.
That's great. That's right.
And so I advise pillow fighting for everyone. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, that's okay.
Here's another one.
Joke things you could share with us before we end the program?
Okay. Well, you want me to just, you know, what's really funny is, do me a favor, people.
Yes.
If you want to go to my website, and you get the whole last chapter of the book is on the website. It's I'm giving you a little hint. It's the quiz at the end, okay? My publisher was kind enough to let me put that on the website. It's drrcomedy.com. If you go to that website, it's free, and do the quiz, but I will read some of the jokes from it. It's a fun quiz, but it's got real information in it, and it's got the answers. You got the answers right there on the website. Try the quiz first and then go for the answers.
Okay.
But let me just read a couple of them for you. Okay.
Sure.
Their traditional diets fail because we hate A, everything and everyone because we're on a freaking diet, B, pureed Brussels sprouts, C, restrictions and commands, or D, shopping for new clothes. Which one do you think it is?
All of the above. No, restrictions and commands.
That's right. I mean, obviously, some of them are easier to figure out than others, but then there's an explanation on why it is that we hate that. And we already talked about that, covered that well. Here's one, number 15 on the website on drrcomedy.com. Number 15, there is a relationship between ingestion of sweetened drinks and A, emergency roadside stops, B, frequency of bee stings, C, obesity, or D, temper tantrums in parents of the very young.
And it sounds like almost everything except the bee stings.
Yeah. Well, actually, there is a real shown demonstration between drinking sweetened drinks and obesity. And I have a whole chapter on why you have to be selective of the drinks and what you drink. People think about the calories they put in their mouth in solid food form and forget about the calories in sweetened drinks and other types of drinks. And I will tell you, even diet drinks may end up not helping you whatsoever. And I explain why that is. The research is now showing. There has never been research, by the way, to show that diet drinks will help you lose weight. And I talk about it. Yeah, I talk about in the book why that is, because your brain registers sweet, thinks it's getting calories. You never give it the calories because it's a artificial sweetener you're ingesting. And your body goes, hey, I was supposed to get those calories you promised me. And then it actually spurs you on to be hungry. And there's lots of things like that. Yeah, absolutely. And I was astounded myself when I started to read that myself.
Right.
Yeah,
one of the things people tend not to count is sweet tea in the South.
Mm-hmm.
That
you're
just drinking iced tea. It's not even a soft drink. But they put so much sugar in it that it winds up being a lot of empty calories.
Let me ask you this.
But it does cause a lot of hyperactivity in small children, too. Sweetened drinks do. We had a birthday party the other day for 12, 10-year-olds, and they were bouncing off the walls, and we realized it was because of the little juice boxes that she had served. Even before we got to the cake, they were bouncing off the walls.
Well, let me tell you, do you know how many teaspoons of sugar are in the average 8-ounce glass of juice?
No.
Okay, envision a glass of water, everybody. Listen carefully.
Yes.
Envision a glass of water, 8 ounces. Now, 1 teaspoon of sugar, 2 teaspoons of sugar, 3 teaspoons, keep going. An 8-ounce glass of juice has about 10 to 12 teaspoons of sugar in it. Now, would you mix that 10 or 12 teaspoons of sugar and stir it around? Think about this. And now drink that down. That's what you're doing when you're drinking juice.
That's amazing.
That's amazing. Orange juice or apple juice. Do you want to give that to your kids? No, give them a whole apple. It has a lot less sugar in it. And they will ingest it much more slowly because the cellulose, the fiber that's in the apple or
right.
the orange, will slow down your absorption of the sugar. And the body has to ingest that cellulose, that fiber. It takes a lot of time for the stomach to digest that. It takes a lot of work. Believe it or not, your body burns calories digesting an orange or an apple. It doesn't burn any calories digesting juice because it's already pre-processed. So the body doesn't have to work as hard. And there's a lot more calories in that. An apple has about 100 calories. A glass of apple juice has about 240, I believe. So you're talking, same thing with a can of Coke, 12 teaspoons of sugar in a can of Coca-Cola. Now, why? You know, think about it, and that's amazing. Let me read you a couple of jokes before we go. Is that okay?
Okay, sure.
I know that you said let's do some jokes, and I mean these are the things I do on. You know, you can go to my website, by the way, and watch videos of my stand-up comedy that I've done, because I shot some of it and put some of the videos up there. And again, it's drrcomedy.com. But here, I'll just read you some random jokes out of the book, and so you know it's fun reading. And I have little like one-liners like I love nuts, that's why I married one in the nuts section. Because I did. I married a real nut. And here's one. Recently, I saw a cooking show chef, true story, make a concoction of deep-fried hamburger between two donuts. I heard she's going into the restaurant business. Is that amazing? Deep-fried hamburger between two donuts? That sounds like a great dinner, doesn't it? She's going into the restaurant business.
Oh, okay. And sometimes on these shows, I've seen things like deep-fried donut sandwiches and things like that, that you wonder why people need to stack calories on top of calories.
It's amazing.
The amount of oil we put in our foods is just amazing.
I have to tell you, by the way, that chef on that cooking show, I'm not going to say who she is, but she complains bitterly that her husband needs to lose 100 pounds, and she can't figure out why. But anyway, you wonder if she's going. You wonder if she's
going.
What was
it I saw the other day? Something like deep-fried chocolate-covered Twinkies.
Right. And what is it with our society that we want to do that? I mean, no, really, seriously.
Yeah.
Once in a while, you know, an indulgence is good, but, oh, my God, you might as well just go. I was hoping she was going to partner with Cardiologist RS, seriously. I mean, that's just asking for trouble, right?
Yeah, well, you were talking about having tort for breakfast. Once in a blue moon, my father's favorite breakfast, which, again, was only occasional, was apple pie with milk on it. And, you know, so if you do that once in a while as a nice indulgence for yourself and do it as a substitute and not on top of the pancakes, that is not a terrible thing to do. But we really have to keep our indulgences in proportion as well.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. Here's another one. My version of convenience food is old pizza sauce in the back of the refrigerator that grows its own toppings. Hey, honey, you like mushrooms, right? I'm not much of a cook. That's one of the things people think, that because I've written a weight loss book and I'm really into, you know, talking about these kind of things, that I must be great in the kitchen. I stay out of the kitchen. If everybody knows what's good for them, they will not let Melanie Rotenberg in the kitchen. That's for real. And I once said to my husband, honey, how do you want your eggs done? Do you want them, you know, deep fried or fried or just tossed, you know? Because the truth of the matter is you might as well just toss them as soon as I'm done. Anyway, what else can I – let's see. I mean, there's some jokes on the website, too. Here's another one. I'll read you one more. I was rummaging through my friend's freezer late one night looking for something to eat when I discovered a package of frozen free-range turkey meatballs. It dawned on me that giving a farm turkey a free-range lifestyle is a lot like taking a guy on death row and putting him in a five-star hotel for a few weeks before his execution, you still come out frozen meatballs.
Oh, dear. So tell me what you think about organic foods, whether it's better for you to have organic foods or not, and the free-range chickens and things like that. Are we driving ourselves crazy, or is it really important to do that?
Well, there's a couple of things working there. One of the things is that I'm a frugal person, and organic foods are extraordinarily expensive. The advantage of organic foods, if they're truly organic, is that you're not dealing with the pesticides residue, and that's very important. We know that we don't want to be eating pesticides residue. So for fresh fruits and vegetables, obviously, if you wash your fruits and vegetables well, thoroughly with soap and water, and just run them under the faucet, you will clean off about 80% of the pesticide residue. So if you feel like you can't afford organics, definitely do that. The thing with organics is they have to be truly organic. That's the other thing. Is there are a lot of people labeling their foods with organic, and there's unfortunately not enough policing of the system. The other thing is with free-range turkey, for instance, the truth is that 100 years ago and before, we were eating animals that were running around, okay? They were getting exercise themselves.
Right.
This is ironic, is that American culture now eats animals that are as, excuse me for saying this, but as fat and lazy as we are. And our farmers have encouraged these animals to be full of fat because that's the taste that we've developed, but not having very much lean muscle themselves. And so the animals that we're eating are not full of lean muscle. And a free-range turkey is a much healthier food to eat because it's gotten to exercise if it's truly free-range. And that's the other thing a lot. I was talking to a person who is very knowledgeable in this field and says most free-range animals get out of their pen for maybe 10 minutes a day. A true free-range or a wild animal, per se, a game animal, tastes totally differently because they're exercising, they're running all day every day. They have very little fat in their muscles, and fat isn't just around the muscle. If you cut up a chicken today and you see that fat around the muscle, but there is fat in between every muscle fiber in a modern-day animal that we eat. Same thing with our own muscles are full of fat if we're overweight. And
we're more used to seeing this in beef because if you look for well marbled beef, that's the fat in the muscle tissue that you're talking about, and it tends to tenderize it too, so it'll be nicer in that respect.
It'll taste good, but it's terrible for you because that fat in between the muscles is exactly what's going to happen to your own body. You need to think in terms of what we all need is more lean muscle, in not just in our diet, but we do need it and you don't need to eat animal protein, by the way. You can get plenty of protein from vegetables.
Right.
So I want to make that clear. But if you're going to eat animals, you should definitely be eating lean muscle animals. But what we all need to do is make more lean muscle in ourselves. That's one of the easiest ways to lose weight permanently, is if you can develop more muscle on your own body. Even if you don't lose weight right away, if you start to exercise, you develop more muscle, and that muscle burns a lot more calories. So you're metabolizing more calories. Even if you're sitting at your computer or you're sitting in your chair reading a book or watching TV, if you've got more muscle, if you have just 5 pounds more muscle on you, you're going to burn so many more calories every day, you're going to lose weight. And if you ate the same number of calories, isn't that amazing? I mean, to me, that's just amazing.
That is, right. Well, this has been delightful. Thank you very much, Dr. Melanie Rotenberg, for being with us today. And we'll look for your book at your website. It's doctorrrcomedy.com, right?
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Joyce. Thank you so much for having
Thank
me today.
Thank you, and I hope everybody out there will get up off the couch and laugh yourself in. So have a good time this week. I hope everybody will be with us again next week. And remember to be well and be a powerful patient. Thank you so much. We'll see you then.